We begin today by looking at information. We've talked on this program a lot about information and what should be known and what should be kept secret. And I'm pleased to welcome to the program today Ronald Goldfarb. He is author of a book called In Confidence, When to Protect Secrecy and When to Require Disclosure. And he is my guest now, also speaking last night at the International Spy Museum at an event called America on a Need-to-Know Basis, Secrecy in a Free Society. Mr. Goldfarb, welcome to the program today.
Good to be with you.
What was it about this this field that you thought was important enough to sit down and write the book In Confidence?
Well, the questions of confidentiality come up in infinite ways, and not a day goes by that I don't read two or three stories in the newspaper about some interesting feature of confidentiality, whether it's profound like state secrets, or mundane, like some sports figure being outed for a crime or moral offense. When Anna Nicole Smith was dead, and before she was buried, her body was in the funeral home for 3 days because the funeral director hadn't signed a confidentiality agreement not to take pictures of her body, if you could believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis required her architect to sign a confidentiality agreement about the drawings for her home in Martha's Vineyard. Whether it's priests talking to penitents, lawyers talking to clients, husbands to wives, doctors to patients, psychiatrists to people they're analyzing, the questions are fascinating, interesting, and very, very changing as the 21st century approaches.
Now, this book talks about a number of different areas of privacy and secrecy and confidentiality, but I was fascinated by the fact that although you've set aside one chapter called Government Secrets, and you deal with issues that the agencies are facing, and I'm going to talk about a couple of those in a minute I'd like to ask you about, especially where it involves a couple agencies kind of going at it. But I see that the federal role in this it really permeates every chapter in the book. There's a reference somewhere to something, whether it's federal law enforcement or you've got a big discussion on HIPAA here, which involves HHS and so forth. So this is, because it permeates, the idea of confidentiality permeates our personal lives, it also permeates the federal life as well.
Well, no question about it, and the question of confidentiality in many respects emanates from the government. For example, and you could write a book about this subject, there are 3 million officials in the federal government who are authorized to classify documents confidential, secret, or top secret. And while there are standards set for when they may do that, there's a lot of subjectivity in their ability to do this. This is a $7 billion a year machinery just to run the closing down, in effect, of public records. So we're classifying, according to one study, 17,000 documents a day, about 16 million a year. And rising in the Bush 7 years of the Bush administration, classifications rose, declassification shrunk, the FOIA culture became more and more remote. So there is a tremendous, almost oceanic change that is going to have to occur if President Obama is to accomplish what he said 1 minute into his administration at 12:01 p.m. of the first day of his administration. He said we're going to have transparency in government, and a few weeks after that, his attorney general said there was going to be a change in policy and FOIA and how that operates. But how you make that kind of an oceanic change is very, very difficult, and it remains to be seen how. But I think there's a great stake in the public having more access to its own public records.
You write in this book, referring to FOIA, it effectively puts the burden on citizens to pursue their interests in discovering information instead of on the government to justify its claim for confidentiality. That's kind of the reverse of what you might think it is.
Well, the whole idea of FOIA was to make public records available. And, you know, in my experience as a lawyer, I can tell you one case where the widow of a very well-known journalist who was killed in the Vietnam War and whose work was very famous, and she wanted to write a biography of his professional life, she went to get his records and was turned down. So we were forced to put in a formal FOIA request. That's expensive, of course. It took us years. We were fought in court. Eventually, they gave us a wheelbarrow full of stuff that most of it was redacted, and we had to fight again to get papers that had information on it that one could read. Eventually, we got it, but if that is supposed to be the way the general public gets information that concerns them, it's, you know, that's a very daunting task. The average person doesn't have the sophistication, time, or funds to fight for this kind of a thing. It shouldn't operate that way. Right now, it takes years to get something in FOIA.
Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to talk about the concept of, with your ideas, ripping up FOIA, starting over, and how we would get maybe from where we are now to your vision for how it would work better for people. We'll do that after we take a commercial break. My guest is Ronald Goldfarb. He's a lawyer, literary agent, and author of In Confidence, When to Protect Secrecy and When to Require Disclosure on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Ronald Goldfarb. He's a lawyer, literary agent, and author of In Confidence, When to Protect Secrecy and When to Require Disclosure. One of the speakers at an event last night at the International Spy Museum, and Mr. Goldfarb, I want to talk to you about that in a little bit, but I'd like to start where we left off before the break talking about FOIA. If the president came to you and said, all right, we're going to tear up FOIA and you're going to rewrite it the way that you would like to see it written, the way that you think it would work best, what would that look like?
Well, I would first tell him that we've got to start at the beginning and not at the end. It's almost like saying, what's your answer for quitting smoking? The best answer is don't start in the beginning. So the first answer is you've got to radically change the classification system. One of the speakers last night, very well informed, the director of the National Security Archive, Tom Blanton, pointed out that recent studies have shown that 50 to 90% of the documents that are classified needn't be classified. Now, if we change that, you immediately have far less need for FOIA in the first place. So that would be the first major remedy. The second thing is, I think he's begun with the issuance of the order of the Attorney General of about 2 or 3 weeks ago, in which he said that all agencies are hereby notified that the presumption under FOIA will be that access should be given, as opposed to the presumption under the Bush administration that you needed to prove your right to this document.
Mm-hmm.
So, that has been done, and then the question is the resources to enforce it. This is the problem with all federal laws, as you know, in other contexts from your program, that we sometimes think we've solved the problem by passing a law that says we're going to do this or that thing, but if the executive agencies of government don't enforce it, then all you have is a nice-sounding law. So the people who are in the FOIA offices that I have interviewed have all told me, and a number of them came up to me last night after our talk at the Spy Museum to say, they're understaffed, and they may be directed, and they may desire to change their policies under FOIA, but there's only so much they can do. They've got rooms full of documents and requests that are backed up for years. So without the enforcement mechanism, that's going to be difficult. So, that's a back and forth answer to your question, but I do think that the biggest remedy is to change the classification system. And I will add that This isn't a fresh idea. There have been five major studies by bipartisan, prestigious blue ribbon commissions through the years which have examined our classification system from the post-World War II era forward, the most recent being the Moynihan Commission, and every one of them have concluded that we are excessive in our classification of documents and that we need to modify that. So, that's where it has to begin. I mean, FOIA is the emergency room, but what we really need to do is have some preventive medicine.
It seems that a lot of people who are following this area, especially as it pertains to the federal government, are sitting around kind of with crossed fingers and crossed toes and everything else they can cross, because it appears that whether it's driven by the administration or whether it's just driven by events, that technology might turn out to be a big factor in this. People are so used to finding information online and being able to mine somebody else's data when it comes to the private sector and even now some local and state governments, that a lot of people seem to think there's just a matter of time until the federal government's almost forced to kind of play along and present this information, when it turns out there's information that people want and can't get it because it's been classified, that might represent kind of a from the ground up type of rumbling that's going to force some of this change.
I think that's a very perceptive insight. I think I agree with you. I think that's going to happen. And it is an example of where technology, which is in many other instances is a threat to our privacy and an invasion of our rights to privacy and confidentiality, but in this respect, it can augment our access to documents that we ought to have access to.
The whole technology issue when it comes to confidentiality presents its own set of issues. You have security issues because there will be cases where there is information that does need to be kept confidential. Who has access? How do you prevent the bad guys from getting it? Is there going to be, do you think, a different set of rules, philosophical approach, or just general mindset? Or do we keep thinking the same way we're thinking and just apply those methods of thinking to the new technology?
No, I think we have to think differently. And HIPAA, which I believe you mentioned earlier, is a classic example of that. The traditional relationship between a physician and patient is so radically different in the 21st century than it was in the beginning of the 20th, that, you know, instead of this quaint old notion of a patient sitting and talking privately to his or her physician and considering that their conversations, however embarrassing or personal they may be, are not shared with others, has no application in the 21st century. Now it takes a village to get medical care. You go to a doctor's office and first you're interviewed by paraprofessionals who take all kinds of personal information from you. You then are talked to by other paraprofessionals in the doctor's office who ask you all kinds of questions about yourself before you meet your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Then you meet your doctor for a few minutes and he sends that information to India or wherever, and they collate it all and send it to some place in Michigan where it's put onto electronic records, eventually gets back to the doctor. The doctor then sends it to the insurance company, and they look at it, and they make the decisions about you and find out things about you that you didn't realize you were sharing with them. If you're unfortunate enough to be in a hospital, one study I read indicated that about 50 people read the medical report at the end of your bed, including dietitians, interns, residents, doctors, nurses, probably the guy who puts the television set on the wall. So it now takes a village to get medical care, where in the old days you have this quaint notion of sitting down in the private sanctity of a doctor's office and talking one-on-one. There's no one-on-one anymore.
Mm-hmm. My doctor's office in Rockville, which I'm very fond of, by the way, features six doctors. So before you even talk about some of the outside places where my information could go, I could see any one of those six doctors at any time I go in. So right there, just right off the bat, that's different than the way healthcare used to be provided.
Right. And I should add that we can't only be afraid of the notions of electronic medical records, because there are very progressive uses for this. And eventually, I think most Farsighted physicians say that we will all have our genetic and physical and pharmaceutical records, you know, in a little disc. My doctor gives me a little disc that I have in my wallet, so that if I'm someplace else and something happens to me, I can show them, you know, all of my medical care to date, what I'm allergic to and whatnot, which is a plus.
Mm-hmm.
I read recently of a person who had had an accident, or who went, had a prescription, I think, and was in a different city. And the pharmacist, when they put through the prescription, was told by the insurance company that covered the prescriptions not to to administer that particular medicine to the person because it was counterproductive to another medicine that person was taking. The pharmacist would never have known this.
Mm-hmm.
This was a wonderful way to double check on something because, as you know, you can have an allergic reaction to one medicine based on another medicine you have.
Yeah.
So having this kind of sophisticated cross checking ability can be a plus. But of course, once you have that kind of record, you know, it's available to hackers and mischief makers and you know, normal accidents. You probably covered in your program recent incidents in the federal government. One was involved the Veterans Administration.
Sure.
By accident, a computer was lost.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of veterans' records had been made public. UCLA had a hacker hack into their student records, and hundreds of thousands of personal records of their students were gotten. And we know of many, many instances like this. You know, during the campaign, a number of the candidates, last presidential campaign, found out that their State Department records had been scrutinized just by curious you know, onlookers who had access to those records.
The record-keeping version of joyriding, kind of.
Exactly. So, you know, technology solves problems, technology creates problems, and the irony is we have to look to technology to find the solutions to the problems they create.